But if you're interested at all in myths and how ancient myths apply to the story of the human family, this is a very interesting one to look at. How many of you are aware of or have tried to dig into women who run with wolves?
I've tried to get the book, but I haven't tried to
open it yet. This is now in the bookstore here at Holden Village. And this is a book that came out last summer, and it caught everybody by surprise. If you tried at Christmas time to get a copy of Women That Run With Wolves, you couldn't find them, because it turned out to be the number one book, hardcover book, for a period of about 6 months now. It even bumped Rush Limbaugh off the top of the bestseller list. And what Clarissa Pinkola Estes has done is to take 25 stories and myths from various traditions around the world, and she uses these stories to explore deep and important issues that apply. Principally, her target is women, and calling women to discover their wild instinctual wisdom and to find a life in which they can really thrive and be nurtured. But this book, I recommend it highly to men, because you'll be very lonely if you don't learn how to run with women who run with wolves. So that's a wonderful book to get into. This, by the way, is only the first of a quartet. Her goal is actually to publish 4 books in which she will be studying 100 different myths and stories, and then using them to explore various kinds of relational and developmental issues. And Women That Run With Wolves is also available in audio tape. And I can tell you that if you're taking a trip from Minneapolis to Madison, Wisconsin, that you can get through the 4 hours of that tape and just arrive just right on time. So it's a wonderful and comparatively painless way to dive into Women That Run With Wolves, to get the tapes and listen to them.
Does she do the reading?
She does the reading, and she is one of the finest storytellers.
Yeah.
She's just absolutely mesmerizing. And so it's worth it just to hear her read these wonderful stories.
Does the library have those tapes, Dave, or do they have to buy them?
I think you'll have to order them, the tapes. But there are good bookstores that are carrying larger and larger sections of audio books. So I think you can find it. Iron John, which is sort of the men's equivalent, he takes one story, The Legend of Iron John, and he uses it to develop a lot of issues dealing with men. This book is also available now in an audio book, and it'll bring you halfway to Minneapolis to listen to those tapes, and that's quite interesting. Robert Bly gives about 40% of the actual text of the book is on the tapes. And so Robert Bly himself is excerpting out what he thinks is the core and the kernel of what he's written. So I thought that was a nice way to do that. I like even better the book Fire in the Belly by Sam Keen. And Sam Keen is also a very serious storyteller in his own right, but that's not his primary vocation or interest. And he discusses also men's issues. And the first session I had, I quoted from a wonderful quotation in which Sam Keen looks at himself as a young teenage boy and assesses what he was like and how he feels about that young boy there. Were any of you here in that first session? Okay, a couple of people. But I'm just going to read a little bit of it. And just to give you a flavor of how Sam Keen writes. It says, "Today I look at an old picture of that 17-year-old boy. He is dressed for the senior prom in a rented white dinner jacket. Lanky, loose-jointed, 2 large hands on hip. The pose clearly adopted from Gary Cooper. Next to him stands his girlfriend, Janet, already looking mature, dressed in the traditional white gown with the traditional purple orchid, filled with the traditional dreams of settling down. They are both virgins. I see hints in his ungainly adolescent body of the man he will become. In the forward-leaning head, slightly sunken chest, the forward-curved shoulders in a perpetual form of a question mark. In the awkwardness of his pose, I see him trying to be suave for the occasion, and play the man while he still feels himself to be a boy. I know he will feel boyish, not a man among men well into his mature years. But it is his face that moves me most, open, shining, filled with a strange power of innocence and strong dreams. His mask of sophistication hides the painful sensitivity he fears is a mark of his inadequacy as a man. I do not see but remember well the loneliness, the uncertainty, the feeling of being both proud and embarrassed by the secret life the boy is living. His clandestine life included many activities not on the list of requirements for being a real man. Keeping a diary, exploring nearby woods and longing for the wilderness, sleeping under the stars, taking long walks alone, waiting and watching to see what will happen when a cowbird laid its eggs in a vireo's nest, masturbating and imagining the woman of his dreams, wondering about the limits of his mind, exploring his dark moods, writing poetry, reading books, playing with ideas, loving his parents, agonizing about war and poverty and injustice, torture, wanting to do something to make the world better. Today, I honor the boy, knowing that he knew far more about manhood than he thought he knew. For instance, the week after prom, he set out on his walkabout, a trip across the U.S. working on the wheat harvest, ranches and carnivals. Hidden in his young heart was a craving to discover his own definition of manhood. Father to the man who is writing this book, he did not know it, but he had already set out on a pilgrimage, a quest to find the Holy Grail. And I think it's a wonderful quotation, and it has a lot to do with what we were pursuing in that first session, and that is how our stories and our experience help us to come to terms and to learn to go back and to accept and love the person we were, even though those years in which we may have felt so inadequate to what life is bringing to us. So that's a good one to look at. I also have some collections of stories, anthologies of stories, which are interesting to look at. Bill White has put together some collections for particularly aimed at Christians that want to find stories to share the Jewish and Christian tradition of faith. And these are in the Holden bookstore. So these are some that are available. I love the collections that come from the National Association for the Preservation and Perpetuation of Storytelling. It's down in Jonesboro, Tennessee, and every fall there's a huge gathering. Storytellers come from all over the country. They'll have maybe as many as 200 storytellers performing, and there'll literally be thousands of people that will camp around the hills of Jonesboro, Tennessee for that day of sharing. What they've done is to select out some of the best stories by the probably the most famous storytellers in our country. And what makes the books interesting is that they also include autobiographical sketches that will tell you about the storytellers and how they got involved in storytelling and what their approach is to this somewhat sometimes demanding craft of telling stories. And I know that here at Holden Village there's a particular interest in natural peoples and traditions, and this is, I think, one of my favorite collections of Native American stories. It's collected by Joseph Brujak, who is very well respected in Native American circles as a very respectful and patient and careful collector of Native American stories. You can also find stories of particular groups. Joseph Brujak's collection is from all different kinds of Native American peoples. I picked this up in Glacier Park on my way to Holden, Blackfoot Lodge Tales, the stories of the prairie people. And so that kind of thing is available. So thank you for your patience.
Quick question?
Yes.
Do you have anything that you particularly recommend for young children, say, 2 to 6, kind of age, preschool?
Oh yes, there are lots of collections of stories that are aimed at young children. In fact, the same source, the National Association for the Preservation and Perpetuation of Storytelling. It has several books for parents to tell stories to their children and how to. There's one called The Hidden Storyteller, which is about how to establish a storytelling tradition in your own family. There's a collection called The Annie Stories, which are stories which are used to help parents to deal with especially troubling situations in the lives of their children, children that may have experienced the traumas of a divorce situation, or may have there may have been instances of abuse or things like this. And so these Annie Stories are stories that have been put together as a way of surfacing and addressing and helping to process those kinds of issues. And of course, any good bookstore will have a whole section devoted to children's stories. It's harder to find good stories for adults than it is for children. I'm going to start with a story that may not seem to be directly related to peace tales or peace issues. It's a Jewish story, and it's entitled The Debate in Sign Language. And you need to remember that this is a story that the Jewish community is telling to itself. And it's told against the background of what has happened to the Jewish people over the years. In the story, there was a king that wanted to expel the Jews from his kingdom. But he was a sporting man and didn't want to just send them away, but he wanted to give them some kind of sporting chance. And so he decided that he would have a contest. And he told the Jews that he would call together a representative of their community, and he would give them three signs. And if they could make the right response to his signs, the Jews could stay and live in peace. And so the Jewish community gathered together, and there was great consternation and great discussion of who they could send, who could represent them, who could take on this responsibility. And even the rabbi said he could not do this. It's too difficult. Finally, Yanko, the chicken farmer, said, well, if no one else will do it, I'll do it. Someone must do this thing. And so that day, the great contest was held. There was a large raised stage, and the king sat on his throne. And little Yanko came up and walked up on the stage and looked at the king. The king said, are you ready? Remember, I will give you three signs. And if you can give me the correct answer, your people can go free. Well, go ahead, said Yanko. The king thrust his hand out like that. And Yanko went like that. The king said, that's right. That is the correct answer. Then the king went like that, and Yanko went like that. The king said again, you have given the right answer. He couldn't understand how this chicken farmer could be so wise. And then the king reached into his pocket and pulled out a piece of cheese. Yanko reached into his pocket and brought out an egg. The king said, you're right. You have answered all three of my challenges. Your people can stay and live in peace. Yanko went back to the village. People gathered around the king. They said, what was this? We didn't understand your signs. The king said, my first sign was to say that the Jews have been scattered around the world. He held up his fist to say, but they are still held as one in the hand of God. I put out my two fingers to signify the fact that there are two kings, the king in heaven and the king on earth. And the little chicken farmer put up one finger to remind us that in the end, there will be only one king. I reached into my pocket, pulled out a piece of cheese to signify the fact that the Jewish religion has become old and moldy. He pulled out an egg to say yes, but it is fresh and new every day. Yanko went back. People said, what happened? He said, I don't know. I don't even know when the contest began. And the king put out his hand like that, like he was going to grab me. I put up my fist to let him know that if he touched me, I'd hit him on the nose. He stuck out his two fingers to poke out my eyes, so I put my finger up to block him. Finally, he must have realized that I was going to stand up to him. So he took out his lunch, and I took out mine. Well, today we would wish that all conflicts could be so waged and the outcome could be so satisfying. It's a wonderful story because it reminds us also that God can sometimes use us for good purposes, even when we don't really know what's going on. I don't know how, if any of you are old enough to be familiar with the Br'er Rabbit and Br'er Possum stories. I'd like to begin today with a story called Br'er Possum's Dilemma. And it's one of my favorite stories. I've sometimes been known to frighten myself telling it, and because I practice in front of a mirror. And there's a role in this story that I find myself slipping into, and it becomes too convincing for my own good. Br'er Possum was a lovely old fellow. He was your original live and let live kind of guy. Every day, when the day was over, he'd climb up in the persimmon tree and hang by his tail and sleep through the night. When the morning came, he'd climb, he'd eat a couple of persimmon, pop them in his mouth, and he'd climb down from the tree and he'd walk down the road to sun himself. On this particular day, as Br'er Possum was walking along, all of a sudden, he heard a voice. "Help me, help me, somebody help me." Wondered where that was coming from. Seemed to be coming right from the road. So he went over there and he looked, and there was a large hole. And Br'er Possum is a very curious sort of fellow, so he went over and peeked down the hole, and he jumped back, because lying down in the hole was old Br'er Snake. And he had heard about old Br'er Snake. Old Br'er Snake was a mean, low-down critter that would just as soon bite you as look at you. So he started to go away. "I'm not going to get near there." But then he heard this voice calling, "Br'er Possum, Br'er Possum. Help me, help me, Br'er Possum, help me." "Oh, what does he want now?" He went over there, because he's a kind-hearted fellow. Went over and looked down. He said, "What do you want?" "The snake said, if I didn't land down here, I got this brick on my back. I'd be mighty obliged to you if you lift that brick off my back." "Well, I don't want to do that. I know about you. You're a mean, low-down critter that just soon bites someone as look at him. I get down there and put that brick off your back, you're going to bite me for sure." "Maybe not." Just about that time, Br'er Possum looked up and he saw a dead branch in a tree. And thought, "Well, maybe I can help this Br'er Snake." And so he climbed up and broke that branch off, and he went down there and he put that branch down there and he pushed the brick off. And, "Well, I got that done." Started down the road again. He heard this voice, "Br'er Possum, Br'er Possum, help me." "What does he want now? I pushed the brick off his back." But he went back there, being a kind-hearted fellow. "What do you want?" The snake said, "I've been down here a long time. These walls are mighty steep. I was wondering if you could lift me out of the hole. I'd be mighty obliged if you'd do that." Well, Br'er Possum didn't like that idea. "I don't know if I'd do that. I know about you. If I did that, you'd bite me for sure." So he remembered he had the stick there anyway, so maybe he could pull this off. So he reaches down there, loops that stick around over her snake, lifts him up and throws him back in the weeds. Well, that wasn't so bad. I was safe enough. Started down the road again. And he heard that voice. "Br'er Possum, Br'er Possum, help me, Br'er Possum." "Oh, what's he want
now.
Well...
He went back there, and Brer Snake climbed out of the weeds, stretched himself out on the road. And I said, I've been down there a mighty long time. I'm really cold. I was wondering if you could put me in your pocket. Warm me up.
Oh, I don't want to put you in my pocket. I put you in my pocket, you're going to bite me for sure.
Maybe not. Well, he decided to do this thing. In addition to being good-hearted, he was basically a brave person. So Brer Snake curled himself up in a little ball, reached down and picked him up, put him in his pocket, started down the road. And Brer Snake lay there real quiet. Didn't move a bit till he got nice and warm. When he got nice and warm, all of a sudden he climbed out of the pocket and he said, ah, 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 nah, I'm gonna bite you. What do you think about that?
Bite me? Why are you gonna go and bite me? I went and pushed the brick off your back. I threw you out of the hole. I carried you around in my pocket. Why are you gonna bite me?
You knew I was a snake when you put me in your pocket. I was practicing that last part one Sunday, one morning in the mirror of the bathroom, and I got so scared it was. It's a story which, within the context of what we're doing here, it's a story that tries to talk to us about the fact that one of the things that leads to violence and war is that sometimes we hide under the belief that this is the way it simply has to be. Some people believe or conceive of themselves as really being compelled to act in this way. I mean, it's just the way I am. I mean, I just go around biting people. And I know people that I like may not like it, but that's just the way it is. It's the way I am. I bite people. And those of you that have seen the movie, The Crying Game, know that in the... How many of you have seen The Crying Game? You know that in that game there is a variation of a story. And it's told about the scorpion and the frog that go across the stream, and in the middle of the stream the scorpion bites the frog, and they're both going under. And of course the frog is, you know, why did you bite me? Now we're both going to die. Nature to God. And that was used to convey the futility of that struggle in Northern Ireland, and where people have been in each other's throats for so long and in such an unremitting and hate-filled conflict that many people say, yeah, that's just the way it is. I mean, we kill Catholics, or we kill Protestants. There's a little story about a man that was walking down the streets of Belfast, and he ran into somebody, and the man walked up to him and said, are you a Catholic or a Protestant? He said, I'm an atheist. He said, yeah, but are you a Catholic atheist or a Protestant atheist? Well, this same story of the scorpion and the frog has also been told in the Middle East for generations. Wasn't invented for The Crying Game. That's one of those pernicious stories that's been around for a long time, in which people kind of chuckle over the fact that groups of people and individuals become locked in a kind of an inevitable conflict. And stories are, I think, a good way of expressing the absurdity and the futility of that kind of attitude, and try and invite people to really look beyond that and to see that there really are more hopeful and helpful ways to live than to go around biting and stinging people, especially when you wind up placing your own life and the life of your own family in jeopardy. And one of the things that you find in the world of story are many attempts to pursue or look at the roots of conflict and violence. And many stories are found about selfishness or pride and arrogance And I'm going to read one story now, which I think is kind of interesting. It's a story about two goats on a bridge. And I recruited two people that have indicated they're willing to be goats for purposes of this story today. So this is a story called The Two Goats on the Bridge. Between two mountains lay a narrow bridge. On each mountain lived a goat. Some days, the goat from the western mountain would cross the bridge to graze on the eastern mountain. Some days, the goat from the eastern mountain would cross the bridge to graze on the western mountain. But one day, both goats began to cross the bridge at the same time. Those goats met in the middle of the bridge. Neither of them wanted to give way.
"Move off,"
shouted the western goat.
"I am crossing this bridge."
"Move yourself,"
brawled the eastern goat.
"I am crossing here."
As neither would retreat, and neither could move forward, they stood in anger for some time. Then at last, they locked horns and began to push. And they were so evenly matched in strength, they succeeded only in pushing each other off the bridge. Wet and furious, they climbed from the river and stalked off toward their homes. And each could be heard to mutter,
"See what his stubbornness has caused."
One version of the story, I did this a while back, and I called the two goats Georgia Pushkin and Sadie Hussein. One of the other things that is involved, obviously, is the failure of people who should know better to assume responsibility for what is going on. And I'd like to share with you rather quickly a story that is also found in Peace Tales, which the book calls Not Our Problem. And I've renamed it and called it A Drop of Honey, because I think it helps to sort of crystallize what's at stake. A king sat with his advisor, eating honey on puffed rice. As they ate, they leaned out of the palace window and watched the street below. They talked of this and that. The king, not paying attention to what he was doing, let a drop of honey fall on the windowsill. His advisor said, "Here, let me clean that up." But the king said, "Servants will do that later. It's not our problem." As they continued to dine on their honey and puffed rice, that drop of honey began to slowly make its way down the windowsill, down to the street below. Soon, a fly landed on that drop of honey and began to eat its meal. Immediately, a gecko sprang from underneath the palace and with a third of its long tongue ate the fly. But a cat had seen the gecko and pounced. Then a dog sprang forward and attacked the cat. Pretty soon, the owner of the cat showed up and began beating the dog. "Say, there seems to be a cat and a dog fight. Some people involved down in the street. Shouldn't we call somebody to stop it?" "It's not our problem," said the king. "We've got other things in our mind now." So the two of them continued to munch on their honey and puffed rice. The cat's owner had arrived and was beating the dog. And the dog's owner ran up and began beating the cat. Soon the two owners were beating each other. "Sire, there are two persons now fighting in the street down below. Don't you think it's time to do something about it?" The king looked lazily out the window. "It's not our problem." The friends of the cat owner began to arrive and began to cheer him on. And the friends of the dog owner came, and they were cheering for him with all their might and main. Soon, both groups entered the fight and began to attack each other. "Sire, there's a whole bunch of people fighting down in the street now. Don't you think we should call somebody to break this up?" The king was too lazy even to look. You can guess what he said. Never mind. It's not our problem. Now soldiers arrived on the scene. At first they tried to break up the fighting, but when they heard the cause of the fight, some sided with the cat's owner. Others sided with the dog's owner. Soon the soldiers too had joined the fight. With the soldiers involved, you can imagine what happened. The fight erupted into a civil war. Houses were burned down. People were harmed. The palace itself was set afire and burned to the ground. And the king and his advisors stood surveying the ruins. And the king said, "Perhaps I was wrong. What's our problem?" I don't know how many of you were here on the 4th of July. How many of you were here for the 4th of July celebration? Quite a few. I heard a story of the 4th of July celebration that was a story disguised as an oration. And it was a story about the secret war between the Legion of the Red Hawk and the Boy Scouts of America. And I had thought about doing that, but I think there probably are enough of you here that had a chance to hear that story that, you know, we'll maybe let that go. But the point of the story was to, it was a story about my brother Paul and myself, and what that story attempts to illustrate is how two young boys get caught up in the excitement and the glamour of war. And it's a very honest story, even though it has some humorous elements to it, because my brother and I were genuinely caught up in the excitement of the war, and we wanted with all our hearts to have an opportunity to go out and fight that great war. Unfortunately, we were in the fourth and fifth grade, and there was not a lot of demand for fourth and fifth grade warriors in the time. And so we had to make do. And we're involved in some compromises. We decided that we would form our own army and fight our battle right there at home. And so we organized the Legion of the Red Hawk. And my brother said that we needed some officers. So he volunteered to be the president and the treasurer. And I asked him, "Well, what am I going to be?" He said, "I could be the vice president and the secretary." Now, I'm sure it doesn't take a whole lot of thought to realize the implications of that division of power. And it meant that my brother Paul had all the power in his hand on the resources, and I had an empty title and most of the stuff work. But I was pleased to be involved anyway. And we went back and fortified this forest kingdom around our house. We dug foxholes and made forts. One thing I didn't tell about on the 4th of July was that we spent a couple of extremely warm days rolling heavy boulders up to the top of a steep sandy slope. They were put up there to roll down on the unsuspecting Japanese. It's not altogether clear to me now why the Japanese would choose to charge up that steep sandy slope when 100 yards down the road they could simply walk into our property on level ground. But when you're living in a world of fantasy, you can have people do anything you want. And so we willed the Japanese to come charging up that steep sandy slope. And while you're standing on top of that steep sandy slope, if you look off to the left, there's a beautiful lake called Sunset Lake, where the water is as pure as the mountain streams around Holden Village. And believe it or not, I went back there 3 years ago to visit Sunset Lake. And I dreaded it because I knew that somehow this treasure of my childhood had been tarnished. And I could not believe it. We came there on a sunny day like this, and the waters of Sunset Lake are still as pure and clean as I remember them. as it were.
That was our Garden of Eden. When we were not waging war against the Japanese, my brother Paul and I were swimming in those wonderful healing waters of Sunset Lake. But there was a fly in our Garden of Eden, a snake in our Garden of Eden. It was the Boy Scouts of America. They had had the audacity to build a camp on our lake. And I blush to tell you all of the silly things that the Boy Scouts did in their camp. Our contempt for the Boy Scouts of America, I think, was even greater than our hatred and fear of the Japanese. And it dawned on us one day that the chances of the Japanese invading our forest kingdom were slim to none. But we had an enemy closer at hand. So my brother Paul called a conclave of the Legion of the Red Hawk. And he said, because the Boy Scouts of America have violated our territorial integrity and have threatened our peace and security, we declare the state of war shall exist between the Legion of the Red Hawk and the Boy Scouts of America. Unfortunately, the Boy Scouts of America were not even aware of our existence. And so it was not what you would call a satisfying conflict. So one day we decided to take the war to the enemy. And so we scouted out the Boy Scout camp for several days. And finally, on August 12, 1943, the full fury of the Legion of the Red Hawk struck that unsuspecting Boy Scout camp, 10 o'clock in the morning. Full fury consisted of my brother Paul and myself, and Roger and Keith Rowe, two neighbor boys that we recruited at the last minute. We charged out into the camp waving spears made from pickweed stalks, and we yelled all this devastating stuff to strike fear into the hearts of the Boy Scouts. Boy Scouts suck eggs. Your mother wears green underwear. I don't quite remember what the significance of that was, but I knew it at the time. It meant something. And our victory was total and complete. I mean, we overran the camp like there was no opposition at all. Of course, the fact that we had chosen to attack the camp when it was completely deserted might have had some effect on the outcome. But I don't want you to think that the Legion of the Red Hawk lacked courage, because we had all sworn that we would give our lives for the Legion of the Red Hawk or for a country if it was needed. I'm sure we would have done that. The Boy Scouts had inadvertently left one of their cabins open, and so we went into the cabin and sort of took it over to headquarters for the afternoon. And they hung sheets over the windows. We took the sheets down, tacked them up alongside the bunks, and made caves to kind of climb into. We spent the afternoon just savoring our moment of victory. And it was a wonderful time, wonderful moment. Conquering warriors, you know, never had more pleasure in what they had accomplished. Until Keith Rowe yelled out, "I hear a car coming down the driveway." And the brave Legion of the Red Hawk fled in absolute terror. We executed what we called at the time a strategic withdrawal. My brother Paul was the first one out, and he ran right through the screen door in his haste to get out of the cabin. The rest of us right on his heels. And we ran down the forest path. We climbed up that steep sandy slope as though it wasn't even there. Ran down the forest pass and didn't stop until we threw ourselves panting and heaving on the hay and the safety of our own mind. As we said on the 4th of July, for all practical purposes, that ended the active hostilities between the Legion of the Red Hawk and the Boy Scouts of America. But memory is a wonderful thing, because over a period of time, we sort of forgot that inglorious ending to the campaign. And when we would get together, the four of us, we would still talk about, you know, that moment of victory when we swept under poles over those dreadful Boy Scouts. My Uncle Doc had gone off to war in the Pacific, and he came back about that time. My brother Paul and I pestered him every day to tell us stories about the Great War, but he would never tell us a single thing. Never told us a single story. And finally he told us and discussed one day in impatience. He said, I don't want to talk about it. He said, war is the most terrible and useless thing in the world. Anything is better than war. And I can honestly tell you that my brother Paul and I didn't have the foggiest idea of what he was talking about. But at least we didn't ask him any other questions. Some years later, I had the privilege of introducing a young man to receive the coveted Eagle Scout Award. And I had an opportunity to say a few remarks. And so I told him how much I respected and admired this young man for his achievements. And respected the Boy Scouts for the opportunities that they've given him to develop his gifts. And then I went on to say to the parents and scout leaders, I don't know if you appreciate how lucky you are to be here. Because there was a moment in the summer of 1943 when, whether they knew it or not, the Boy Scouts of America stood in deadly peril. That shows you how shameless, absolutely shameless storytellers are. Because 10 minutes ago, I told you that I wouldn't tell them.
Yeah.
Terrible. Anyway, we would like to go back to our bridge. Things don't have to happen that way. There are other possibilities. It's interesting. This is another version of the same story. And it comes from another country. The first version was from Russia. This is another version of the same story. Between two mountains lay a narrow bridge. On each mountain lived a goat. Sounds familiar. Some days the goat from the western mountain would cross the bridge to graze on the eastern mountain. Some days the goat from the eastern mountain would cross the bridge to graze on the western mountain. But one day, both goats began to cross the bridge at the same time. The two goats met in the middle of the bridge.
We have a problem here,
said the western goat.
So it seems,
said the eastern goat.
I do not want to back up,
said the western goat.
Neither do I,
said the eastern goat.
This bridge is narrow, but perhaps...
Perhaps if we both are very careful,
added the western goat,
we could pass without falling,
concluded the eastern goat.
We can try,
agreed the two goats. And cautiously, they squeezed past, each being careful not to overbalance the other. Thus, the goats passed peacefully and went on their way. Each could be heard to mutter,
what a cooperative fellow he is.
Another story that conveys the same idea, except it involves a personal decision on the part of someone to act in a reconciling way in a situation of conflict. This is also in Peace Tales, and it's called Old Joe and the Carpenter. Old Joe lived way out in the countryside, and he had one good neighbor. And they had been friends all their lives long. It seemed they had grown old together. Now their spouses were dead and buried, their children raised and living lives on their own in other places. All they had left was their farms and each other. But for the first time in their long relationship, they had had an argument. It was a silly argument. It was over a stray calf that neither one of them really needed. It seems the calf was found on Joe's neighbor's land, and so he claimed it as his own. But old Joe said, no, no, that calf has the same markings as my favorite cow. I recognize that. That's my calf. No doubt about it. Well, they were both a bit stubborn, unlike us. So the upshot of it was that they stopped talking to each other. That happened about a week before. And it seemed that a dark cloud had settled over old Joe. until there came a knock on the door. He really wasn't expecting anybody that morning, and as he opened the door, he saw standing before him a young man with a box of wooden tools on his shoulder. He had a kind voice and a rather dark, deep eyes. He said, "I'm a carpenter. I'm looking for a bit of work. Maybe you have some small jobs around here that I could help you with." Well, old Joe wasn't the kind of fellow to take someone on just right off, so he brought him into the kitchen and sat him down. Gave him some stew that he had on the back of the stove. There's some homemade bread there, and great fresh that morning. Some fresh churned butter and some homemade jam. And while they were sitting there and eating, Joe decided he liked this young fellow. He said, "I do have a job for you. Just look right there through my window. See that farm over there? That's my neighbor's place. See that creek running right down there between our property lines? Well, that creek wasn't there last week. My neighbor did that to spite me, Dag Burnett. He took his plow up there with a tractor and he dug a big furrow from the upper pond and he flooded it. What kind of a neighbor is that? Well, I want you to do one better. Since he wants us divided that way, you go out there and build a fence. A big, tall fence. So we won't even have to see his place anymore. Could you do that?" Carpenter said, "Well, if you've got the lumber and the nails, I've got the tools. I'll be able to do a job that you might." Joe had to go to town to get some supplies, so he hitched up his wagon and he showed the carpenter everything he needed. Told him where his tools were. And well, that carpenter, he carried everything he needed right down to that creek side and started to work. And all of his work, how he could work, went smooth and fast. He did his measuring and sawing and nailing. About sunset, when old Joe returned, the carpenter had finished his work. But when old Joe pulled up in that wagon, his eyes opened wide and his jaw dropped down, because there wasn't a fence there at all. It was a bridge going from one side of the creek to the other. It had handrails on it and all. And the finest piece of work you could ever see. And his neighbor was just starting to cross to the other side of the bridge with his hand stuck out. He was saying, "Joe, you're quite a fella to build this bridge and to do it now. I've never been able to do that. I'm glad we're going to be friends again." And Joe, he put his arms around his neighbor and he said, "Oh, by the way, that calf is yours. I've known it all along. And I want to be your friend too." About that time, the carpenter started putting his tools in the box and hoisted them on his shoulder. He started to walk away. Joe said, "No, no, wait. Come on back, young fellow. I want you to stay on. I got lots of projects for you to do around here." But the carpenter just smiled and he said, "I'd like to stay on, Joe. But you see, I can't. I've got more bridges to build. All over the place." So he walked on, and there ends my tale. I'm sure you all grew up as I did with that old saying, strong fences make good neighbors. Well, this is a story that calls that into question. I'm going to stop just for a minute and kind of give you a chance to kind of bombard it with a bunch of stories. And just wondering if any of you want to share something, or it doesn't have to be about peace or war. It was something that maybe was suggested to you today. Last night we had 12 children here from Narnia. So we asked, we were talking about the land and asked them if they had any treasured place. And the little girl raised her hand. "Oh, I've got a place like that. My backyard is a big tree. And there's a patch that comes out there. It's a little place back in there, and that's where I like to go." "Well, what do you do there?" "Huh? Mostly just think. Just a place to think.
Yesterday, my housemate, Maya, who some of you know, she's now three. She said, Jan, we were waiting for supper and we'd come too early. Jan, do you want to see my sacred house? I said, no, where is your sacred house, Maya? So there sits a rabbit on the wall in the garden right beyond the steps up there. We walked around and under there the tree makes a bigger smell and it's quite dark. And she said, you want to sit down? I sat down. And she said, you can come to my sacred house.
Sure, you felt pleased. It's wonderful.
I saw that secret house the first day we were here, and I was thinking, ooh, that looks like a wonderful place for children.
I have to tell you, after bringing my daughter here since 1981, and she's now 18, and that was their secret house. Maybe, maybe, maybe. Uh-huh. I'm sure many children have enjoyed that secret house.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have such places. There weren't too many people that spoke about secret places, but I've had at least three people from the class come up to me since then, the interline of places, and say, well, I didn't say anything about that, you know, right? Sure you do. That's the way that goes. I wanted to end today, and we're getting up close to time, to end with a Native American story that I learned from Gail Ross, who is a wonderful Cherokee storyteller. She's actually the great-great-granddaughter of John Ross, who is the sort of the paramount head of the Cherokee Nation at the time that they began their journey of tears out to Oklahoma. And she's a beautiful, tall, statuesque-looking woman, and a wonderful storyteller. And she has a story which she calls Strawberries. And this is a story that goes back to the old, old times. The times when there was no television or radio. A time when people lived close to the land. And a time when people could talk to the animals. And in which the spirits were close and provided guidance to the people. It's a story about the first man and the first woman who were husband and wife. And they loved each other very much. And they lived in peace and happiness and harmony. But even people who love each other sometimes quarrel. And so it happened with the first man and the first woman. Neither one of them really even remembered how the quarrel started or what it was about. But that didn't make any difference because angry words were spoken and feelings were hurt, and a great chasm came between them. And finally, in anger and hurt, the woman walked away. And at first the man was glad to be rid of his troublesome woman. But as time went by, he found himself missing this woman. He missed the sound of her voice, and the sound of her footfall in the house. He even missed her complaining. And with each passing day, he felt emptier and emptier inside. And finally, he began to cry. And the spirit came by. And the spirit said, man, why are you crying? And the man said, because my wife has gone away. And the spirit said, why did your woman go away? Did you quarrel with her? And the man hung his head and nodded. The spirit said, would you quarrel with her again if she were here? The man said no. He just wanted to be together again. The spirit took pity on him. And he said, I have seen your woman walking to the east toward the setting sun. I will go after her and see if I can slow her steps. And so the spirit went after the woman, and he found her walking along, walking very fast, with her face set forward, looking neither to the right nor the left. It is well known that an angry woman walks very fast. The spirit tried to slow her down, but nothing he did seemed to help. He saw some mulberry bushes by the side of the trail, and so he shook his rattle, and the mulberry bushes blossomed. And he shook his rattle again, and they ripened into fruit. But the woman looked neither to the right nor to the left. And the spirit saw some apple trees, and so he shook his rattle, and the apple tree blossomed. He shook his rattle again, and they ripened into fruit. The woman looked neither to the right nor to the left, and she did not slow her steps. And finally the spirit realized that he would have to find some way for the woman to look down and to slow her steps for a moment. So he thought he would create a whole new kind of fruit. And he shook his rattle, and the floor of the forest was covered by a green carpet. And he shook his rattle again, and that green carpet was covered with little white flowers in the shape of stars. And he shook his rattle again, and those flowers bloomed into ripe red berries in the shape of the human heart. And as the woman walked along, her footsteps crushed the berries, and the rich aroma rose up to her nostrils, and she looked down. And she saw the beautiful red berries. And she reached down to pick the berries, and she tasted them. And they were sweet, sweet like the taste of love itself. And so she went along, picking the berries and eating them. And as she went along, out of the corner of her eye, she saw the figure of her husband coming. But now the anger was gone. And so she waited. And the two of them went on together, eating the berries and talking. And finally they found themselves back at home, where they lived in peace and happiness and harmony for the rest of their days. And this is why among the Cherokee people, strawberries are called the berries of peace and the berries of love to this very day.